Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with emerging threat analyst and sci-fi author Robert Marston Fanny. And you are aware that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has just released a report which spurred the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine to jeer that climate change is just a pussy and not a tiger at all. What's your reaction to what we've seen so far of the early releases of this new IPCC report?
My personal opinion is that these news outlets really need to listen hard to the scientists. The scientists, number one, are extraordinarily conservative. If you took a layman like me and read the scientific reports, I have a decent understanding of the scientific reports because of my experience. But when I read the scientific reports, they, in many cases, pretty terrifying. And what you hear from the scientists are qualified, in many cases, reticent explanations of what is going on. And these scientists, they have large, usually in many cases, large research budgets or grants that require a degree of public support. And so when they produce these reports that come across as being very negative when it comes to climate change, they in many cases qualify the results. And in some cases in the media, they sound almost like they're second guessing themselves. In truth, they're just trying to cover their bases. If you're from NOAA or NASA and you have this major research grant, you're not going to want to come out and wave the flag, oh, the sky is falling. You know, you're going to do your best to provide as much factual information as possible in a way that is reassuring so as to not result in a negative public response, for the most part. I read an article on this subject written by James Hansen about scientific reticence, which is certainly worth reading by anyone who is interested in the subject. But to these newspapers, I would say look at the meteorologists, look at the scientists who more and more often are becoming very concerned. One of the scientists currently, it was just an article out today, he's a meteorologist, and just declared, you know what? It's too risky. I am not going to use air travel anymore. I need to cut my carbon footprint. And he essentially, for all these meetings, he travels about 75,000 miles a year in an airplane, which results in around 150 tons of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere due to his consumption. And he says, you know what? It's not worth it. It's too dangerous. I can't keep flying. So where is the New York Times article about this scientist who is so concerned that he cannot keep flying? He's going to go out of his way to do video conferencing and go through the entire, you know, major inconvenience, in a way cutting off his access to what is a staple of Western lifestyle, in order to try and prevent something that he sees coming down the road.
Well, scientists like Michael Mann say the IPCC has dangerously lowballed the polar ice melt and rising seas, but they hardly touch on another possible planetary game changer, which you have called the methane monster. What does sea level rise or even tsunamis have to do with more methane into the atmosphere?
Well, there are a number of mechanisms that can release methane into the atmosphere. Recently, a scientific report was published investigating the issue of a link between sea level rise and methane release. And what they found was that as sea level rises, it creates additional pressure on underwater slope structures along the borders of continental shelves. And as this pressure increases, it increases the risk of what they call slope collapse. Now, most of the methane hydrates in the ocean are buried beneath many feet or many tens of feet of mud and sediment. And this cap protects them from a rapid release, you know, should ocean temperatures warm up in that region. Not only does it have to penetrate to the surface of the seabed, but also beneath the surface of the seabed to denature methane hydrates and cause them to start to release. And then even after they denature, they have to find a pathway to reach the surface, get up through the water, and then get into the atmosphere. A number of scientists have poo-pooed the idea of rapid methane release by saying, well, there's really not much in the way of mechanisms that can release all these massive volumes of hydrates that are stored beneath this cap. Well, the recent paper shows that as sea level rises, the pressure increases on these slopes, and it greatly increases the risk of slope collapse, which uncovers the methane, exposes it to warmer seas, and can cause very rapid eruptions of methane from the seabed and to the surface of the ocean and into the atmosphere. It was found that during the last ice age and the end of the last ice age to the most recent, as sea level rose, there were a much greater number of these slope collapse events, on the order of about 10 times the normal rate, at least. And so the link between slope collapse and methane releases and tsunamis is that when slopes collapse underwater, it's like an earthquake. If you're familiar with the earthquakes that occurred in Indonesia, where you had these large rebound events that created very large tidal waves, slope collapse can create a similar situation, or depending on the volume of the material, something that is worse. Because if you have many, many, many hundreds of cubic miles of rock that collapse, then the size of the related displacement of water is massive. And so not only does slope collapse increase the risk of methane release, which can very rapidly increase temperatures above and beyond what we're causing through human emission, but also can result in extraordinary large, potentially even mega tsunamis occurring in regions that where we would not normally expect them.
This is Radio EcoShock, and Robert Marston Fanny, we started out with a confession from your new book, Growth Shock. Would you tell us about that book?
I began writing Growth Shock about 9 years ago. I was not sure if I would ever publish it. It was more of a way for me to hedge my bets. I had began to receive a number of letters, emails, various scientific articles that people were asking me to read about the issues of human overpopulation and related overconsumption, human consumption of rapidly depleting and damaging resources, primarily fossil fuels, and related climate change. What Growth Shock does is it talks about the combination of these three aspects, overpopulation and overconsumption, resource depletion, and climate change as a combined shock to the human system. It reflects on earlier work, some of the work, for example, by other authors. One of the primary works was one that was published in 1972 called The Limits to Growth, which I'm sure the ecologists in your audience are probably familiar with. It takes principles from those works and attempts to expand on them and generate real-world circumstances and scenarios and potential solutions related to those problems. As I wrote Growth Shock, the related problems became worse, especially climate change, which began to ramp up far more rapidly than the IPCC consensus assessment had predicted, especially when you start to look at not just warming, but changes in the Earth system, such as loss of ice sheets, loss of glaciers, the rate at which the deep ocean is warming, which has very bad ecological effects worldwide. At a point, I felt that it was timely and necessary to publish the work. In my opinion, I am uncertain how many people will read it, but I feel that I add my voice to a growing number who are making similar warnings, and I think the warning at this point must be made.
Well, how do people find out more about Growth Shock as a book?
Growth Shock is on Amazon, and it is currently only available in ebook form. But if you go to Amazon, you can read the first chapter or so. If it's something that interests you, you can purchase it. The proceeds, I am donating a portion of the proceeds, at least 50%, to 350.org, an organization that I feel has been very effective in both raising awareness and also providing political action to stop the exploitation of the worst resources, that being unconventional fossil fuels. So if you're still interested, you can take a look at robertscribbler.com, and there are a number of blogs on the issue of Growth Shock, and I'll be writing some more as we go.
I would be remiss if we didn't check in with your alter ego, the lifetime obsession you have with science fiction writing. Can you just introduce us to Luthiel's Song, that series?
Well, Luthiel, as a fantasy character, is actually a metaphor for the Earth. The word that I use for Luthiel in the science fiction language that I used for the novel means water through stone, which is a metaphor. When I began writing Luthiel's Song, I wanted to both create a story that all people could enjoy, but also sprinkle it with a number of values that I thought were important as we go forward. And so the issues of veganism are brought up in the book, which both me and my wife find to be very important, both from a sustainability aspect and a compassion aspect.
Robert Fanny, what are you working on next when it comes to emerging threats?
Well, as far as future projects, I think that currently the most interesting and terrifying aspect of, or one of the most interesting and terrifying aspects of climate change is the rate at which we are losing our ice worldwide and how that affects, you know, us as a civilization, as a species, and as a global system. And I think that one of the things the scientists really need to take a look at is what happens when a world such as ours moves from a glacial state to a hothouse state. We've done a lot of research about periods of time when it was very warm and it became much warmer. And this happened about 50 million years ago in an event called the PETM that James Hansen has written a lot about and written some very interesting work on, and has compared it to what could happen now in a not an absolute worst case, but a near worst case scenario. But back then there were no glaciers. And the physical change from glaciers to water have impacts on the Earth system that are unique. And the last time an event such as this happened was 250 million years ago, approximately, during the various Permian extinction events, where there was a glaciated world which slowly transitioned to a hothouse world. And I do not know. I mean, there are a number of scientific papers that hint at what could happen as a result, including ocean stratification, or what they call a Canfield ocean state, due to a combination of ocean warming, but also stratification as a result of a sudden influx of fresh water on the surface, which essentially kills off the oceans and can result in devastating effects to land masses long term, or life on land long term. So what we are seeing now, and the reason why I think we should ask this question, is that the pace at which we are adding greenhouse gas forcing to the Earth system is 6 times as rapid as any time ever seen in geological history. We have, you know, massive stores of methane locked in both ice and ocean systems, and we have ice. What happens if that changes, and what happens if it changes rapidly? And so that's what my next work will explore.
As you say, we are in trouble. It takes imagination and the ability to interpret science to forecast possible futures. And Robert Marston Fanny is one of those fortunate combinations, and I think he helps us see through the fog. You can find his blog at robertscribbler.wordpress.com. And I have links to Robert's articles and books coming up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert Fanny, thank you for that illuminating blog. I mean that. And I hope to have you back again on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, sir. It was fantastic talking to you, and I would be more than happy to come back.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
We humans have always believed the sea is so vast we can't seriously damage it. A new report warns this isn't so. It's called The State of the Ocean 2013 Perils, Prognoses, and Proposals. We've reached one of the lead authors, Professor Alex Rogers of Somerville College, Oxford, and Scientific Director of IPSO, the International Program on the State of the Ocean. Dr. Rogers, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
The subhead of the press release says greater, faster, closer. Should we be worried about the state of the oceans overall?
Absolutely. We know that over the past 50 years, the oceans have been under increasing stress from overfishing, destructive fishing practices, and pollution. But over this time, climate change effects have also been slowly creeping in. So, for example, the oceans have absorbed something like 90% of the heat coming from the effects of greenhouse gases on atmospheric warming. So the ocean's been getting warmer. They've also been getting more acidic as a result of taking up carbon dioxide.
The United Nations' latest climate report concludes that most of our carbon pollution is falling into the oceans rather than the land. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. The oceans perform this marvelous service for us by taking up something like one-third of the carbon dioxide that we're emitting every year. Unfortunately, the side effect of that is that that carbon dioxide reacts with seawater to produce carbonic acid, and that is reducing the amount of calcium carbonate in seawater, which many marine organisms use to build their skeletons from or their shells.
You talk about a deadly trio of stressors we are imposing on the sea. The first is deoxygenation. Many of us have the impression dead zones are just a problem around a few river deltas. Is that true?
Dead zones are certainly a coastal phenomena, but what we've seen in the wider ocean is an increase in the extent of what are called oxygen minimum zones. So this is a zone found around all of the oceans where oxygen naturally reaches a lower concentration than nearer the surface as a result of bacterial breakdown of organic matter sinking out from surface waters. These dead zones are expanding because of the effect of warming of the ocean, which decreases the mixing of the oceans vertically and also decreases the amount of oxygen that seawater can hold. We've already seen that this is compressing the habitat of large marine fish like marlin, which need high oxygen concentrations to maintain their very high metabolic rates.
You've also said that perhaps this will happen more in some areas of the North Pacific and especially in tropical seas. Why those areas, and how could global warming cause that?
Well, those areas already naturally have lower concentrations of oxygen associated with them. And as I said, one of the effects of the sea warming is that it can hold less oxygen. So naturally, there are low oxygen concentrations in warmer water. This is one reason why, for example, some Antarctic animals, which live in very, very cold water, can reach a giant size compared to their warmer water relatives.
And next up on your list is ocean acidification. It's a huge topic, I know, but can you just give us an introduction to what some of the worries are there?
Yes, ocean acidification has been nicknamed climate change's evil twin in that it's something that we weren't really that aware of. Everyone was aware of the fact that the oceans were warming, and that has major consequences in terms of causing things like mass coral bleaching. But acidification is actually caused by carbon dioxide dissolving into seawater, and this produces carbonic acid, which then alters the natural carbonate equilibrium in seawater. What this means for marine animals that grow shells or skeletons from calcium carbonate is that their growth rates are reduced, or their shells or skeletons are actually changed in structure, they become weaker. But also, as research is continuing, more and more effects of acidification are being found. So, for example, it's been discovered that acidification affects the ability of marine animals to smell. So if acidification continues, we may see effects like larval reef fish unable to find their habitats to settle on and then grow up into adults because they can no longer perceive their environment in the way that they can in the present day.
And then you report warming itself can damage the ocean. I wonder how that can work and how serious a problem that is.
This is certainly something which already is having a pervasive effect on marine life. So many people think of climate change as something which will cause impacts in the future. But we know that since 1979, for example, when we saw the first mass coral bleaching events, that the oceans have already passed, if you like, a tipping point. Mass coral bleaching occurs when the oceans warm up and temperatures get too high and the corals eject symbiotic microscopic algae that they rely on for their energy and their nutrients, and the corals then die. One of these warming events in 1997-1998 killed 16% of the world's coral reefs. We also see all over the world now poleward shifts in the distribution of marine life as a response to warming temperatures, changes in the timing of biological events in the ocean, and shifts in the structure of entire ecosystems as species move to try and keep pace with favorable temperatures that they like to live in.
The international community has suggested that 2 degrees is the limit of global atmospheric warming that we shouldn't pass. Are there similar lines we can set for the ocean heating?
Well, in our view, 2 degrees is probably already too high for marine ecosystems like coral reefs. And if anything, we should be trying to reduce those targets. The way things are going at the moment, it's unlikely that we'll actually meet that 2-degree target. It's more likely that we'll actually overshoot those targets. And that is going to have catastrophic consequences for marine ecosystems, particularly very sensitive ones like coral reefs. And we must remember here that these are the most diverse marine ecosystems on Earth. They also produce huge socio-economic services for humankind in parts of the world where those coral reefs occur. So there are direct economic consequences of these impacts.
This is Alex Smith. I'm talking with Oxford marine biologist Alex Rogers on a new report about the state of the oceans. We've heard recently that a warming ocean has disrupted the hydrological cycle. Very warm seas appear to be linked with extreme rainfall events or more violent storms. Is that theory or is there solid science behind that?
I mean, this is slightly out of my area of expertise because I'm a marine biologist, but it's certainly the case that greater heat stored up in the oceans can result when that's combined with natural environmental cycles in these extreme weather events. So, for example, it's been found that the oceans periodically appear to dump their heat during what are called El Niño events, and those events are coupled with very, very heavy rainfall, particularly in areas like South America, but their effects are felt over a much, much wider area.
Alex Rogers, we're also demolishing ocean life by overfishing. In Canada, the historic cod fishery was killed off. And this is going on all around the world, and it's almost unreported. What did you find?
Well, this is a very interesting area because there's been a raging debate between scientists on whether the management of fisheries are improving or getting worse. And it would seem that looking at the evidence as a whole, some fisheries are improving in their state, but those fisheries are mainly around the developed nations, places like Europe, the United States and Canada, where there is a large infrastructure to support that fisheries management. Elsewhere in the world, and we're talking about something like 80% of world fisheries, the news is not so good. And in fact, overall, yields from fishing are declining globally as a result of this mismanagement.
Despite all that you've said, I know there are some people who will be asking this obvious question. We live on land after all. Why do we have to act to save the oceans? It's a huge question, but what do you think?
Well, the more work I do on the oceans and the services they provide for humankind and indeed for the entire Earth's life support system, the more I'm convinced that we should be very serious about maintaining their diversity and their function. Life in the oceans plays a pivotal role in the big biogeochemical cycles that maintain conditions on Earth as we've known them throughout the course of human evolution and beyond. Essentially, these climate change effects are causing changes to the way that life is structured, and we can expect, as a result, major changes in terms of ecosystem function. One of these, as I said, is the fact that the oceans take up large amounts of carbon dioxide, and we're very concerned that some of the impacts of climate change will actually feed back through the oceans and reduce the ocean's capacity to take up that carbon dioxide, with the obvious result that global warming will accelerate.
When we talk about solutions, I have to wonder, can we really separate the ocean from the atmosphere? Aren't they part of one system?
Insofar as greenhouse gas emissions are concerned, they are part of one system. And this is a very important thing to bear in mind. We often forget about the oceans as part of that system. The simple fact is that emissions have to be reduced. Otherwise, we're going to be faced with these major problems that are discussed in the IPCO papers. And these problems are creeping up on us very, very quickly. The rate of carbon dioxide change in the atmosphere is probably as great or greater than has been seen at any time over the last 300 million years. So we're talking about a very, very significant event and really a one-off experiment that we're performing with the Earth's atmosphere and therefore with the oceans and indeed with the entire biosphere.
And I want to ask Professor Rogers, solutions for overfishing have been proposed for decades. Are there any signs of sanity when it comes to regulating the fishing industry worldwide?
As I said, there have been some really good initiatives in reducing overfishing around the coastal waters of developed states. That's not the case in many other parts of the world. And the really crazy thing here is that actually we know the answers to solving this problem. There are too many fishing vessels out in the oceans fishing the stocks that are there. Fishing fleets are subsidized, continue to fish when they're no longer profitable and when the fish stocks they're targeting are in decline. Also, there's a large area of the oceans, which we call the high seas, which lie beyond national waters, which are very poorly regulated with regards to fishing. So it's a really urgent matter that we get new governance arrangements for the high seas that improve our ability to manage human activities. Here we're talking about fishing, but there are also many other activities which take place out on the oceans to make those activities more sustainable and to really improve the supply of fish.
Where will the new report be published, and where can my listeners find out more on the web?
Well, IPCO has a website which is available at www.stateoftheocean.org. That's State of the Ocean is all one word. The papers that report these findings have been published in the journal Marine Pollution Bulletin. These papers will be available for 6 months for readers to download free of charge.
As we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the thing to add here is that many people are not aware of the problems that we face in the oceans and are not aware of how those problems are connected with the issue of climate change. So I'd really, really recommend that your listeners really go out there and find out for themselves what the issues are that we're facing.
Our guest has been marine biologist Alex Rogers. He is a professor of conservation biology at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Somerville College, along with co-lead author Professor Dan LaFollette and many other expert scientists. Dr. Rogers has released a major new report titled The State of the Ocean 2013, Perils, Prognoses, and Proposals. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock. That's it this week for Radio Activism. Download our past programs and help the cause at our website, ecoshock.org. The blog is at ecoshock.info. Our opening music was Dance, live at the Labyrinth Shambhala Music Festival 2011.